consensus needs to just be there in the moment to get you through the activity. It doesn't have to be lasting.
The new brand you come up with, it's not about just pulling it off a shelf and going, here's your new brand. What is wonderful about it is if you use the process to engage leaders along the way, so when you unfurl that flag at the end, everybody sees themselves in it.
If professional services marketing sometimes feels like throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks, this podcast is for you. Welcome to Educated Spaghetti, marketing ideas that stick, presented by Right Hat. On each episode, your host, brand strategist Lisanne Schwartz, sits down with marketing pros and creative thinkers to untangle the marketing chaos. So pull up a chair at the Educated Spaghetti table and let's dig in.
Today, we're talking about one of the biggest challenges in professional services marketing, how to build consensus around a project, or as we sometimes think of it, how to herd the cats. My guest is Roy Sexton, Chief Marketing Officer at the global law firm Vedder Price. He is an accomplished consensus builder and a little bit of a Renaissance man. Over the past 25 years, Roy has helped bring people together around complex projects in law firms, healthcare groups, professional associations, arts organizations, and mission-driven nonprofits. He's led global rebrands, created integrated marketing plans for over a dozen business combinations, and coordinated the rollout of strategic messaging to thousands of professionals. He's also a past international president of the Legal Marketing Association, a published author and film critic, an award-winning regional actor, and a devoted dog parent. And really, I've barely scratched the surface here. So Roy, welcome to the podcast.
Wow, you made me sound really good. Thank you. You know, our producer, Maddie, said that she'd help with fact-checking. We might need something from that intro because I don't know that I'm the person you just described.
Well, you are an impressive guy, and that's one of the reasons that we really wanted you here on the podcast to talk about building consensus. Because it seems like in all of your diverse experiences, you have very often found yourself situated in places where smart, creative, opinionated people gather. And sometimes that can lead to disagreement. Have you always been a consensus builder? Have you always been drawn to this kind of thing?
Is this supposed to be personal therapy? if my father's listening, he's like, uh-oh. You know, yeah, I didn't know I'd go there right off the bat. So I'm an only child, and my parents raised me as an equal in many ways to them. When I went to kindergarten, my mother sent me off in penny loafers carrying a briefcase and wondered why people were beating the crap out of me on the way home. But be that as it may, I called my parents by their first names because I didn't know what mom, I didn't know the words mom and dad. I just heard them call each other Don and Susie. So I did the same. And to their credit, you know, it was the 70s. People were a little, they just let me keep doing that. And the upshot of that is I had a lot of confidence and certainty at an early age. The downside is I found myself sometimes being the referee for their arguments. Not fun. And then also my mother came from a fairly rambunctious Southern family, and there was always somebody who had their nose out of joint about something. And as a little child, I'd sit there listening to all this going, if only somebody would just say this. And as I got older, I started saying those things at family gatherings and it worked. So, you know, I learned hard lessons from family that I think have served me well in business settings. I as an English and theater major in college, I feel like I'm supremely unqualified to do all the things that you just described that I've done. But I think the thing that I do, and maybe it's from a theater training, is listening and paying attention and realizing more often than not, tension in the workplace comes from two places. Either someone has an agenda that runs counter to somebody else's, but more often than not, it's that somebody's saying something one way and somebody's saying the same thing a different way, and they're speaking past each other. And sometimes, and hopefully not in an overbearing way, I find my power has been to insert myself and say, hey, I think what I'm hearing is this. And 9 out of 10 times, both of those parties say, yeah, that's right. And then we can move forward because for some reason, they're not speaking the same language, or they're approaching it from different energy levels, and they're missing each other. And so I think that's probably been what's carried me through 25, 30 years of a working life without getting fired yet, knock wood.
So this is a skill that you learned a long time ago.
Yeah.
Do you find that it comes into play more in professional services than in other settings that you've been in?
Absolutely. It took me a minute to end up here in legal. I worked at Deloitte Consulting early on in my career, moved to Detroit, then ended up at a healthcare system. I worked there thinking I would work there until I figured out what I wanted to be when I grew up. I stayed there 11 years. Every time I was ready to leave, I got a promotion. I'm like, well, I guess I'm sticking around here. And then in 2012, I worked with an executive coach once who said, you like putting yourself in harm's way just to see what will happen, don't you? And I guess I do. And they just threw my resume out there willy-nilly. And my first firm hired me. It was a mortgage foreclosure firm because the man whose parents had founded the firm, or they'd passed away and he was running it. And then he decided he wanted to run for Congress. So he wanted someone to come in and do what he had done. He had a real marketing bent. And so I stepped into that role. That was my first time with attorneys. And I was nearly 40 at that point. That's when I got involved in the Legal Marketing Association, because I thought, I need a group of people to explain to me what world have I just entered. But in that, I did find that all of those things I had done in my life, and doctors and lawyers, there's a whole conversation that could be had about that in terms of highly skilled professionals who learn how to do a thing that are thrust then into a business environment. And with the confidence they've gained learning the very specific set of tasks, they then extrapolate that out and apply it to everything. Doctors usually are wise enough to go, I don't know billing. I don't know marketing. You handle it. But they still have pretty strong opinions. Lawyers, again, I think because of the way the business model has evolved, often they were having to do that work themselves until their firms got big enough that they could hire external voices. And sometimes they still think they got to manage those of us who didn't go to law school, like we're summer associates, and they don't. And so I think understanding that attorney mindset is one that comes from care and great anxiety and great intelligence, which reminds me of my mother, especially. I was in a good position. I think, again, I have found that as long as the attorneys know I am as nervous as they are, I am as worried about the risk facing the brand as they are, but without taking some risk, there is no reward, and I will do it with caution and thoughtfully. I usually have them supportive of the things that I'm doing. And I also always remind myself, and I have no qualms about this, this isn't my house. You know, I'm hired here to lead the marketing efforts. It is a privilege. It is a gift. I'm grateful for that. But there are other owners of this house, quite literally, and they have a stake in the game and they know things I don't know. So between the two of us, or between the two parties, we can come to some mutual agreement. What I know, what works from a marketing perspective, how we can get a voice out there, how we can do it in a way that keeps the brand safe. But what they know about the history of the firm, what they know about their clients, how they do and don't want to be positioned. And when you get there, it can be such a rich dynamic and so rewarding.
How do you build that kind of credibility and relationship with them that's going to allow you to really help them move forward?
This is a softball, because you have something you want me to say, and I remembered it. Driving in, I'm like, not that we had a prep call. Am I ruining all the theater of this? But there was a,
you know,
there was a
peek
piece
behind
I
the
noticed.
Curtain.
Yeah. But before I talk about that piece, building the suspense, and it won't be that impressive when I finally say it. There are two things. One, and I say this to everybody that joins my team, especially if, and I don't want to sound ageist or in the reverse, if you're new to this profession, I will tell people, don't screw up the easy stuff because you'll never get to the hard stuff. Attorneys are testers by nature. And if you send them something that's got typos in it or is poorly written, or you don't respond quickly to an easy request, they are going to determine very quickly that you don't have the credibility to work on the harder things. So it doesn't mean you have to be overly deferential, but be respectful, respond, get them what they need, and give them that plus to it. You know, give them what they needed and then say, hey, I gave some additional thought to this. You could do X, Y, and Z. They might not take you up on those things, but then they see you're part of the conversation. So that's how I develop those relationships. Actually, there's a third point I'll make after the second point that I know you want me to make. She's like, Roy, stop. But I'm a fan.
We have no secrets anymore.
No, I have none. And neither do you when you talk to me. But I like to pilot things. And by that, I mean, we're going to do it. And I plan for it to be something bigger than it is. Now I am really divulging my secrets. But I know law firms especially, I learned early on, if I come at it, in healthcare, you could come at something big. You could announce a big campaign. You could, and it got everyone really excited. If you do that on a law firm, there are at least 10 people that are going to point out everything that's wrong with what you're going to do. And instead of talking to you, they're going to go to everybody else in the organization, including the CEO, to complain about what is he doing? Doesn't he know this is a problem? Blah, 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 blah. And then you're never going to leave the room alive. So I take the air out of that by saying, we're just piloting this. We're trying it over here, the corner of the world. Don't worry. Not a big deal. And then once I prove to them it works, and it usually does, and if it doesn't, I'm the first one to say it's not working. Let's retool. But once it works in this sliver of the organization, then we expand. In my early days at my prior firm, everyone told me, don't bother with social media. It's worthless. We don't need it. But I'm like, we have nothing else. Do you mind if I just pilot this in the evening on my own? Well, 6 years later, their audience grew to like 30,000. I can't remember what they had. They were winning awards for their social media. All the people who were telling me we shouldn't bother with it, that first thing out of their mouth when an attorney needed attention, well, we know we have a great social media program. And I'm like, yeah, you do. But if I painted that vision for you 6 years ago, you wouldn't have let me do it. But if in the quiet of the night, while I'm watching Real Housewives on Bravo or whatever we used to watch, and I'm doing this stuff and building it up and building the credibility for it, and it just becomes part of the firmament, then you've sold it. So, you know, there you are. And if I want to build relationships with attorneys, and this is going to sound so stalkerish, this whole thing, we probably should just torpedo this interview right now because I'm giving everything away. And I sound crazy. I go into offices of the attorneys and they're like I am. They have trophies around. They have tchotchkes. They have things from their past that mean something to them. I'm looking right now at 3 movie posters, Xanadu, Dick Tracy, and Everything Everywhere All at Once. Those are all conversation pieces if someone wants to ask me. Xanadu is a horrible movie, but it's one of my favorites and I watched it like 83 times as a child. Dick Tracy is who I want to be when I grow up. I loved that movie so much, even though nobody really did. And Everything Everywhere All at Once, I don't know that I love the movie that much, but I sure feel like that movie title every day. But, you know, if I strike up conversation with the attorneys and learn who they are and what motivates them, that creates that personal connection and the work becomes that much easier.
What do you do when you are trying to get buy-in in a challenging situation? I mean, for example, you have a group that has a very clear leader and you want to hear what the leader has to say, but you also want others to contribute and be engaged in the project.
I mean, there are a couple of tricks, one of which is simply to say, hey, I haven't heard from some of the other voices around the room. I want to gather as much information as possible so I can put together the most holistic solution. Now, that doesn't take away from the leader who might feel like you're questioning them, but saying, hey, you've brought these people together for a reason. Haven't gotten a chance to hear from some of the other folks. Let's hear what some of their pain points are. And then when I hear what those pain points are, that gives me something to exploit and then come to a solution that maybe meets halfway between what the leader maybe feels very strongly about. And I'll, it's hard to speak in abstraction, so I'll be specific here without naming names. Most recently, I was with a practice group and the leader of the group was saying, we need more name awareness. What can we do? And I said, you know, media relations in the practice of law that you have is really, really powerful. Oh, we've tried that before. Nothing really comes of it. I was quoted a couple times in an article and I didn't really get anything out of it. And the rest, everyone else is being really eerily silent. And I just went there and I said, yes, but your practice is established now. You don't need anything from this. But there are junior people in the room who the name recognition, the credibility that media relations brings will benefit from that, and they have time, they can participate, and cumulatively, all of your voices around these issues are going to raise the brand and the practice area's brand within the organization. Pause, waiting for my head to be handed to me. To the attorney leader's credit, he said, well, you might have a point there, but I don't know. Don't want to completely concede the point. And fortunately, then a couple of the junior people in the room, they jumped in and said, yeah, I really am hungry for that. And I said, let's take a separate meeting, because I knew we didn't need to resolve that with 8 different people in the room, some of which were agnostic about media relations. I said, that'll be one of our takeaways. The 2-3 of us will meet. I brought in our practice development manager. We talked it through, got them connected to the media relations folks we are working through. And I know with media relations, you cast a wide net because the attorneys are going to be busy, the media aren't interested, whatever. But as long as you start planting the seeds and building the comfort with it, eventually it snowballs. So that was a case where I could tell often in law firms, the person who's been put in a leadership role, they're put there because they have a really big book of business already. And now they're making all the declarations about what should happen in marketing, but they're not the ones that really are going to benefit from it. It's the ones who are still growing their practices. So you have to highlight that in a respectful way and say, let me build the toolkit to help your colleagues grow their business. And if they grow their business, you all benefit because at the end of the year, you've made that much more money you get to divvy up.
It sounds like a fairly time-consuming process.
It is.
So in other words, you can't just walk in with a great idea and expect that everyone's going to fall in line,
No. Even
when it's a great idea.
Mm-mm. And I've seen too many marketers self-immolate that way. And I don't want to be that person. I've tried really intentionally not to do that here. I mean, I have been LMA president. I've worked at four different firms. It would be very easy for me to fall into old habits, and I probably have, and I'm not even that aware of it, and just say, well, this worked here, do this. But it's a new group of people. You have to think like a consultant and say, how, even in my own team, yes, I'm the CMO. I could just declare you will go do this. But I know that if they feel a sense of ownership, if they've been part of the solution creation, if I brought in some things that worked other places but might need modification here, they're going to own them that much more. And I can take a vacation day occasionally. So it does take time, but it is very much worth it. And, you know, I've seen that happen with marketers who just go in and go, well, here's your new brand. Here's your new this. And they're missing a great opportunity to build relationships. The new brand you come up with, and you know this from the work you do, it's not about just pulling it off a shelf and going, here's your new brand. That's actually the least interesting part, is what's at the end. What is wonderful about it is if you use the process to engage leaders along the way, so when you unfurl that flag at the end, everybody sees themselves in it. They feel that's them. That's the true power of the brand. It's not the logo. It's not the fonts. It's not the new website. That's all great. Those are outcomes. But what really happens if you do it correctly is you've brought people into the process and they feel like they're part of something. Yes, that takes time, but then that makes the work that much easier because they're already bought into it. They're not fighting you on something that you just declared in the still of the night and launched into the ether.
Is there ever a situation where it's okay to proceed without consensus in a law firm?
Yeah, with caution. I'm a fan of the FYI, or the, if I don't hear from you, we're going to proceed because I don't want to miss the opportunity. So at least it's out there as a CYA. And it, you know, because again, this is, it sounds like I'm punting here. This is their organization, the shareholders, and I need to respect that. And I'm good with that. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. It's like a new crossword puzzle. Like, how can I bring folks along to a new way of thinking, and how will I grow in the process too? I don't have all the answers. In fact, I have very few of them. But there are times, you know, and I think it's more around the pieces of work. Like, I think a marketing team can fall too much in the realm of every attorney has to read every social media post and every post on the website and make sure they approve before you. Okay, don't do that to yourselves. Own the space and say, I'm running the small town newspaper here. We're putting it out there. If you have an issue with it, it's digital ink. It can be redone. Nothing we're doing is putting the organization in harm's way. But if you don't like the way the opening sentence was written, we can fix that. But again, you have to build that credibility of the attorneys that they let you alone. And also you have to tell them, look, I'm saving you the grief. It's going to be out there much more quickly. You don't, because attorneys, if they're given something to proofread, now it's another task, something they have to overthink. They're going to rewrite within an inch of their lives. The reader doesn't care that much. It's just getting the information out there in a way that's as engaging as possible, but balancing expediency with perfection. And so I think those kind of tasks are where sometimes people try to build consensus. It's like, why are you having a practice area leader, the attorney, a business development manager, and the writer all look at a social media post? That's absurd. You know, just get it out.
So you talked a little bit about lawyers in particular having the experience where they were the ones who did the marketing. And so It's hard to let that go. Are there other common obstacles that you find in professional services that are sort of unique to the sector? Unique to the sector, if they.
Some of them we saw in healthcare as well. I would say, I don't find that as much here. But my other firms, spending money, You know, it's interesting to me, and I don't, if you go to my LinkedIn, you'll know that I'm, what firms I'm talking about. So, but, you know, there was a tendency to second guess investments that actually were strategic while letting another attorney buy a $30,000 sponsorship because they wanted to keep that attorney happy. And not that critical eye toward, are we investing in the long-term growth of the organization, or are we satisfying an individual in the moment? And one firm several ago, I literally had to get the managing partner's permission every time I spent $50. You know, and that's what I would say to law firm leadership. If you bring in someone who's leading your marketing area, give them the budget, let them manage the budget, let them spend against that budget, and have them on a monthly basis tell you how their run rate is. And if they seem like they're going to go over budget, that's when you start micromanaging everything they're doing. But to every expenditure, you have to cross Scylla and Charybdis to get there, to get them. You just become discouraged. You don't want to bring new ideas to them anymore. So I think, and I think that's because a lot of law firms still manage by checkbook accounting a little bit. They're like, how much money did we bring in? How much do we have at the end of the year? What do we get to split up? And I think they've got to get to the point where they run more like businesses and say, this is the budget for the year. You're managing that. Do what you need to do. I don't have that problem here, but I think a lot of law firms don't realize they tie the hands of their marketing leaders by not just saying, here are the resources you have to use. And I think that the third leg of that stool is there can be a lot of second guessing and micromanagement of how leaders are managing their own teams in legal. I think a lot of attorneys still think of marketing as a staffing function. You know, well, you're bringing people to help me do what I want to do. And I'm like, no, I'm building a team to help the firm do what the firm needs to do. I'm not there just to provide you. You have a legal assistant. They're there to help you. And that's not to diminish that work, that they do God's work, many of the legal assistants. But I'm not there to provide staffing for you. I'm there to provide strategic marketing on behalf of the organization that benefits you. And you might have a wish list and we can talk that through, but I'm not just giving you a person that you can fill their agenda all day long with kind of whims and ideas. And again, a firm a couple of firms ago, they were the kind of firm that had a PA and you would be summoned by the PA, even though you were like four doors down from the person, and you go, Roy Sexton, please go to so-and-so's office. I'm like, really? And you go in there. And I remember one conversation I had with this partner, and they said, we need to put a page on the website that says we do electrical, vehicle electrification networks. And I go, well, do we do that? Don't ask the questions. Just do what I said. And I'm thinking, well, what am I going to write about? And to me, that it didn't hurt my feelings or bother my ego. I just thought, we're not being pure to who we are as a firm if we're just throwing a page on the website because you think you're going to have a conversation with somebody. And that's where I think firms, again, if they don't let marketing build up its team, do what they need to do, give them some hard truth, and they're just like, here's your task, go get it done. You may as well light your money on fire in the parking lot, because it's go lawyer and let us pull out of you what we need. And we will have a negotiation. We will be collaborative. But you know, don't tie our hands from a financial perspective.
How do you even build consensus that is lasting, you know, when there are so many potential pitfalls?
It doesn't have to be lasting. I think I see this a lot from my LMA life. When people have been leaders at LMA, they want to leave a legacy. Don't worry about that. Trying to leave a legacy means you're not going to leave any legacy at all. You're going to be so worried about what happens after you that you're not dealing with the moment you're in. Consensus needs to just be there in the moment to get you through the activity. And then once they see, mostly the consensus needs to be built around the launch of something or the development of it. And then once you've got that consensus, demonstrate the value. And chances are, either people aren't going to pay attention anymore. They're just going to assume it's part. Like I said, the social media thing is just, this is what we do now. What didn't used to be. Or if they don't like elements of what you're doing, then you can have that conversation at the individual level. But consensus in and of itself isn't that useful, except for what you need to do to get the clearance to do the next thing. So when people are like, I need to bring lasting consensus, or I need to be forever valued in my role in the organization, it's ephemeral. You're not going to achieve that. And you're going to frustrate yourself in the process. And also it varies. You have a different combination of people for different issues. So you're trying to bring, and consensus is also one of those things. And I struggle with this in law firms. especially if they're the kind of firm that everybody has to buy into something before it can move forward. That's insane. It's not going to happen. If you get 50 to 60% and you've worked with the leaders and they're on board, you're going to have a few people that are outliers, and hopefully they'll come around when they see what you've accomplished. But don't try to get consensus for consensus sake before you can even set a foot out at your door. And I think the other tip is in this any industry you're in, anywhere you are, and again, it's going to feel a bit ingratiating maybe, who are the influencers that are going to be in the conversation? And have separate conversations with them first and say, here's what I'm trying to do. I'd really love to have you on board. So when you get in that larger room, 40 to 50% of those people have already heard the idea. They're already supportive of it. They bring everybody else along because they're the first to say, yeah, I think this is a good idea. And you can be transparent about that. You can say, I happen to be in the hallway talking to so-and-so. We talked about this already. You know, to be sneaky about it. But, you know, I did fundraising in one of my early jobs, and I was terrible at it. But one of the things I learned about capital campaigns is, and this may be common knowledge, it was revelatory to me 30 years ago. They have raised nearly 70 to 80% of the money for the capital campaign before they even announce it. Because they know that if they say we're doing a $100 million capital campaign and they've raised $80 million, that last $20 million is going to be that much easier. Or they'll even go beyond it because everybody's there. Oh, you already have that much money? I want to be part of that. So part of the consensus building is take that same idea, build that back channel consensus from some individuals who you know will be on board. So when the more difficult personalities might be in the room, they're like, oh, okay, they're on board. I'll be on board too.
How do you build this kind of consensus culture into your team so that it's not just, you know, one individual, but it becomes your department that is really good at this?
Yeah. So I think it has to start at home. I hope I'm not anyway. It'd be interesting if you had the same conversation with people who worked for me and they're like, nope, he's full of crap. I'm not a top-down leader, first and foremost. And I think sometimes that might really frustrate people because I'm not the person who's just going to go do this. Here's our plan. Make it happen. And there are some people that want that leader that are just like, now I have in the back of my mind about four options. But when I'm talking again to individuals on the team and I start with the leaders and I figure out what motivates you, what do you want in your career? Where do you want to be? Where do you want to go? And we start to bring in the priorities aligned with the opportunities those people want and they feel like they're heard. They become, again, the exemplar in they're the early people that are adopting some of the ideas. And then you start to work through the rest of the team. And then when we have larger team meetings, you have open dialogue about something that's in formation. And you take the input from everybody in the team. You don't have to do everything everybody said. And you make it very clear up front. We might not do all the things that come out of this conversation, but I want to make sure we all have been part of it. And then that is when I become decisive. So after that conversation's happened, and like I said, I have four ideas in the back of my mind, and hopefully one of them lined up with where the group was moving, then I come back to the group and codify it and say, okay, great. Based on the conversations I've had with leaders and with the larger team, here's where we're going to net out. I know that doesn't quite align with what some of you wanted. I want to try it. Let's see what happens. If we need to revisit, we need to revisit. So it feels like it's a dialogue. And then as that works within the team, you start to see them model that similar behavior because they see it working and they feel heard. And I try to step out of it sometimes too. If I see someone not listening, but I know they benefited from me listening to them, I will sometimes just say point on, you know, remember how much it meant to you that I listened to your perspective? I don't think you're doing that over here with your colleague.
When you think about training your team and helping your team to evolve into this, are there any resources that you would recommend to them to consult that have inspired or informed your approach?
This question is comparable to the question people go, what business books would you recommend? I'm always like, I don't read Who Moved My Cheese. I don't read any of that stuff. The only thing comparable to that I've ever read in my life is The World is Flat. That one really still sticks with me. I remember things like Kodak forgot they were selling memories. They thought they were selling films, so they went out of business. The music industry thought they were selling plastic discs, not music experience, so they nearly went out of business. So that's one that just I always think about. Remember what we're doing and why we're here. The other story that I tell far too much is Walt Disney was building Disneyland, and there was a flower bed between Main Street in Tomorrowland, and people were walking through the flower bed, and all the gardeners said, we need a fence around this. And Walt said, we need a sidewalk there. So that's something that will always define where is the energy going and how can we lean into that? That informs how I build a team, how I want the team to think about their work. Yes, there's sort of the best practice and the way we've done things before, but what is the energy of your market telling you and how do you want to respond to that and be agile enough and know you have the latitude and the freedom to do that? Just tell me what you're doing so I can support you. But I would say the other books and bits of media and things that inform me are film and plays. You know, Shakespeare tells me more than I've ever wanted to know about human relations. King Lear, Macbeth. I don't think I'm supposed to say that out loud. Well, if I'm in the theater, I'm not supposed to say Macbeth, but I guess I can say
right. The Scottish play.
Yeah, the Scottish play. Eugene O'Neill, I did my master's thesis in my theater program on Ah Wilderness and Long Day's Journey Into Night, which I think are both, one's the comic, one's the dramatic telling of a family that is in various states of turmoil. And I think those pieces to me inform how I understand the human condition, how people do or don't speak to each other directly about the things they want and need. I'm a big comic book fan. I don't know. I really love, we talked about this in our prep call, Marvel movies and things. I there's something about the hero's journey that will always keep me motivated. And a friend of mine, Stephanie Marr, who is at Jaffe and we work together at Clark Hill, she sent me this Instagram. I know I'm not answering your question, but too bad. She sent me this Instagram clip the other day and she goes, this is you, isn't it? And it was a man who said, if you need to understand how to get through office politics, pretend you're in a sitcom. To me, there's entertainment value everywhere I turn. And if I take it with that perspective, it helps me keep a healthy distance on things.
What is your secret sauce for building consensus?
I thought you were going to ask what my secret sauce is for spaghetti. You know, I used to cook. I haven't cooked in 25 years ago. And so it was probably a year or two after we met that I never cooked again because I used to take, we're vegetarian now, but I'd start with a box of tuna helper and I would just keep adding things to it because if I cooked, I wanted it to last a week. Like I was cooking for an army because it bored me to cook. And so I would add all the other noodles, whatever they were, just all mixed up. And then I'd start adding vegetables randomly. And he'd come to this cauldron and he said, it looked like it had a pulse. And one day we were eating and he took a bite and he said, is this a cucumber? Did you put a cucumber in here? And I'm like, it's a vegetable, can it? And he goes, and I never cooked again because he's smart. He's like, I'll handle the food. That's not your question. So my secret sauce for consensus is, and I never do it very well, listen more than you talk. My friend Megan McKenna Clark Hill, she used to say it when we do orientation with the attorneys, you have two ears and one mouth. You know, consider the ratio there and make sure. And I think for me, that's the best way to build consensus. And yes, it takes time. Yes, it takes investment. But it's the way you're going to learn. Every individual has a different, you know, diversity. I know diversity, equity, inclusion has become such a loaded thing and it's a shame. Because we all are different. We all have a different collection of influences that have brought us to the moment we are together. And I can't presume you're my enemy. You can't presume I'm yours. We are here together to work through something. And the only way I'm going to learn what makes you tick, what motivates you, is by listening. And listening past, my friend Kelly McKinnon says, what's the question behind the question? And she's really good. When someone comes at her with a challenge, she's like, well, tell me more. What's behind that? And let that person unpack for you the issues, because as they do, there will be some nugget of gold where you will see that alignment that you have. And you will say, I get that. I can help you with that. And being able to say, I get that. I can help you with that. That brings that person on board. And it is. It's a numbers game. You have some to go one by one by one, but it gets easier over time. Once you've built those relationships within an organization, you've done that work together, the next time it's that much easier. The next time it's that much easier. And I think, you know, that's why I generally last. Most of my jobs, I've been there. My first at Oakwood, I was there 12 years. My first firm, I was there 6-7 years. Clark Hill, I was there 6-7 years. I like to be at a place for a while because that's when I can really get to know people. And to your point about how do you create lasting consensus, maybe it's that. It's not perpetual consensus. It's just that we have a shared history of working together and of moving in the same direction. So the next time it becomes that much easier.
It's been great speaking with you. Thank you so much. Folks out there, if you would like to connect with Roy, you can find him on LinkedIn. You can reach him at rsexton@vetterprice.com.
That's today's serving of Educated Spaghetti. Thank you to Maddie Lingle for producing this episode and managing our social media, Charlene Fabi for our logo design and music, and you for listening. To comment on today's topic or suggest future episodes, visit righthat.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next time for more marketing ideas that stick.